The conference committee will come to order, and I'd like to start out by maybe having the conferees introduce themselves. Some of us know each other, and some people may be new to the Higher Ed Conference Committee. And let's have the staff introduce themselves too. And I apologize that two of my members aren't here yet, but maybe they'll come in during the introductions. House, want to start?
Represent Carol McFarland, 53B, Waverly.
Representative Larry Haas, 15B, St. Cloud.
Representative Linda Slocum, 63B, Richfield and Wilmington.
David Bly from House District 25B, Northfield and Belle Plaine.
Kathy Novak, House Research.
Doug Berg, House Fiscal.
Tom Recovina, House District 5A.
And Senator Thomasoni is my
And some more of the House staff is here.
Jim Wallner,
Laura Sand with DFL Research.
Mike Ballou with Republican Research.
Great, welcome. And I'm Senator Sandy Pappas from St. Paul.
Dennis Albrecht, Senate Fiscal Staff.
John Fuller, Senate Counsel.
Catherine Ryan, Committee Administrator.
Ann Lynch, State Senator from the Rochester area.
Sharon Erickson-Ropes from Winona.
Senator Ron Latt, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, and Golden Valley.
And more staff? Okay, great. Welcome. Maybe we could start with some opening comments. Tom, do you want to make any?
You're the boss today. You go ahead.
Well, I actually have laryngitis, but I'm drinking.
I'll take that.
My voice comes and goes, and when I drink a lot of tea, it comes, but it may occasionally go. So I apologize. I do not have anything to do with that FLU word. Nothing. I haven't been in Mexico, so don't be freaked out or anything. Well, I think we have a very difficult task ahead of us because, you know, everyone knows about the difficulty with the state budget, and so we've been asked to cut budgets. And I was here in 2003 when we had to do that, and it's not usually a very pleasant task. So I think we all have to remember that these are tough times. We're all in this together, and this may not be our favorite year to be conferees, but we do have a job to do. We hope that we won't have to cut too deep and the federal stimulus money will help, and I applaud the House that was able to garner more federal stimulus money than the Senate higher ed bill has. We are fortunate that we have some extra money for students through the federal Pell Grant. So we hope that we'll be able to do some good things. The Senate bill has some, we think, some good reform initiatives in it that we'd like to look forward to explaining to the House. I think that we hope that we can all be respectful, be on time for our conference committees, and work together. We're very interested in hearing from the public, and especially from the Office of Higher Education representing the governor. And we hope that individuals from the Office of Higher Education will feel free at any time to join us at the table. We may have you up there for long periods of time. We also, as always, want to hear from students, from the University of Minnesota, and from MNSCU, and any others who are concerned about provisions in the bill. Our leadership has asked us to do as much as we can in open and transparently and in public. So we hope that we can have really good, honest, open debates over policy differences, and obviously we're going to have fiscal differences too, with both the governor's staff and his representatives and each other. I do want to make one announcement that at 3:30 we're going to recess the conference committee. Representative Rukavina and I need to go to a meeting, And we're not exactly sure when we're going to come back. It would probably be an hour and a half. I would suggest that during that time period, people do eat an early dinner or a late lunch, whatever it may be, or a substantial hearty snack, because we will go into the evening as long as my voice lasts.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
I have to be at another conference committee at 6:30. So... because I'm also chairing the Economic Development Housing.
You may have an earlier deadline than we do.
Yes.
Well, I was hoping, Representative Rukavina, that we could meet long hours today and tomorrow, since you told me you had some conflicts on the weekend. So that may be difficult then to meet your schedule. Yes. You have lots of responsibilities over in the House. So.
But if you would want to continue with my core conferees, I trust them and my staff. It's like, you know, but I have to be. But see, my staff has to all be with me and my other.
Okay, well, we'll
work on
it. We'll try to work it out. We'll try to work it out.
They're whispering in one ear, ma'am.
Yeah. Let's try to get as much work as we can get done in the next 35 minutes, because we're starting kind of late. Okay, our first topic of conversation, we're doing something a little bit different this year that we think will maybe streamline the process a little more rather than sitting through that awful 2 hours where we do the side-by-sides. We're going to go right into the meat of the bill and have discussions. And so I hope everyone is geared up and ready. And the first discussion is the state grant. And Perhaps I'll start to give you a moment to think, and by articulating Senator Roebling, thank you for joining us. You missed the chance when we all introduced ourselves, but Senator Roebling is the ranking minority member on the Higher Education Committee and has been on the Conference Committee for many years. Thank you for joining us. We're starting out talking about the state grant. You have a 13-page, how many pages is it? Abridged side-by-side in front of you, and the first topic is the state grant program. And let me just articulate briefly, and my members may want to chime in at some point, is that we asked the Office of Higher Education to do a study on the state grant and to come back with recommendations. And so the Senate approach is to look at that study and address the issues that were presented in the study. There were several things that hadn't been adjusted in years, the caps, the living and miscellaneous expense was, you know, not really in keeping with what the real cost of LME is. And so that's what the Senate bill was attempting to do. Does someone want to articulate for us the rationale behind the House approach to the state grant?
Well, Madam Chair, I think we took a very considerate approach to all the students in the system, whether they're in the private or public institutions, and we went up quite a bit in the living and miscellaneous expenses and lowered the student share, which used up a lot of our money, but, you know, I'm more than willing to listen to some of your reasoning why you chose to go the way you did. You know, we put a cap on the 2 years based on the highest 2 year college in the system, which my understanding is talking about the staff is being interpreted a little differently by what that means from the Office of Higher Education, so I may have to straighten them out before the day ends, but you know, I think we both have some very good things in our proposals, and I think that Minnesota should be proud of their state grant program. And as you said, to open up this conversation in this conference committee, you know, we're looking at some really tough times, and the federal stimulus and the way it was used by the House, and we're pretty much copying what the governor proposed in that area. I understand that you know, leadership that had different ideas, but, you know, we've tried to maximize that money. But down the road, everyone in this room knows what's going to happen if
the economy doesn't pick up or we don't raise some sort of revenue. And I just don't want to see the students have to go through what they did back in 2003, like you cited. So that's what we tried to do, is use that federal money and some other state dollars wisely and try to give every system, whether it was private for profit, private not for profit, or the MNSCU or university system, an equal distribution of those funds.
I think all the conferees received a letter from the governor in which he said that he was pleased that both the House and the Senate bill do keep all of the Pell Grant money that generates a surplus in the state grant program. So does anyone from the Office of Higher Education want to comment any further on the state grant and your preferences? Mr. Mishkanis?
Madam Chair and members of the Conference Committee, my name is Mark Mishkanis with the Office of Higher Education. A little background for the House members, at least on the way the governor's proposal put together, because I think we did have some testimony on the Senate side when we presented the state grant report to you. We found that over the course of the last 18 to 20 months as we studied the state grant that when you don't have the price right, then none of the other analysis makes sense to you. It's really hard to determine whether the assigned family share is right, the assigned student share is right. And came to the conclusion that until you get that price right, that everything else is problematic. And then the next question, of course, is what do you mean by right price? So we tried to identify external benchmarks, if you will, to measure whether we had the right LME or the right tuition caps, things like that. So that's the underlying analysis behind the governor's recommendation, and I think it comes out of that very report that the two major findings of the report were that the state grant model is pretty fundamentally sound. And this, I should mention, included all of the stakeholders in the student groups, institutional groups, and the like, as we've talked through that. But fundamentally, the state grant program is sound, and price really matters. You have to get that right first. So that was the underlying reason, and it goes back to, I think, some of the conversation you just had about the two different proposals.
Okay, anything else? Any questions from Mr. Mishkanis? Any preference on House or Senate approach or a different approach?
Madam Chair, again, it gets back to the extent that you change, you affect the price. I think that's the most important thing, whether it's LME or the tuition caps. The other changes are outside that. Those that kind of a general approach. So I think, given where we came from, that direction initially would be the preferable.
Mr. Madam Chair, I didn't understand that answer.
Representative Rukavina. Mr. Mishkanis.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina.
You'd be more direct with me, Mr. Mishkanis.
Madam Chair.
You like your plan better than mine?
Do LME and the tuition caps first, and then whatever you have left, do the rest, is my sense. So.
So you're talking about LME price. And the tuition caps.
Tuition caps and LME. Those are the two price components. And I said, do those first, and then as you, whether it's the family responsibility on the Senate side or some of the other changes on the House side. Those are the two major things to get done first.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, since, you know, if there are no questions, more further questions for Mr. Mishkanis, maybe we should bring the students up now and see who they
like. Are there students here who would, from the associations, that would like to testify? We'd certainly like to hear your opinion. And if you have handouts, I can get your hand up. Welcome to the conference committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jacob Whitler, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association.
And I am Graham Allen from the Minnesota State University Student Association.
Okay, so proceed.
They're
going. Did you need something?
I was just questioning. They have a different handout than we do.
There are two. There are two handouts, right?
We don't have.
Oh. Okay. We only have one. Coming?
One on each side.
We want circles over here, too.
As long as you get the circle.
We like that one.
Thank you.
So, the handouts coming around right now are some information that our two associations have compiled based on some data that we got from MNSU and from the Office of Higher Education. And if you look at the one with the circle charts on there, the top chart represents the distribution of Pell Grants to students in Minnesota based on sector, showing that the majority of Pell Grant recipients are in the MNSU system, both the 2 and 4 year level, and smaller percentages at the U of M, and then private, nonprofit, and for-profit institutions. And that's just representative of the fact that we have more students than the other sectors do. And if you go down to the second pie chart there, that is based on an analysis from the Office of Higher Education. If all of the surplus money that was created by the increase in Pell funding was put into the living and miscellaneous expense, that shows the distribution of where those dollars would go, once again broken down by Minnesota students by sector. And as you can see, it matches up very very nicely with where the Pell Grant money would be going had it just gone straight through. So we feel that any increase that goes into the LME will most fairly distribute the money based on where it came from in the original Pell increase. And the second chart that we handed out, the bar chart, is kind of a side-by-side comparison of all of the proposals that are out there. Starting on the left is the House proposal, and these are just kind of illustrative. They're percentages that have, it's not exact, but very close to where the percentages break down based on where the money will go distributed out on the various proposals. So the House, you can see that would shift a little bit to the MNSU two-year. The Senate is the second bar, which shows kind of a more even distribution, I guess. The governor's proposal is the third bar, and the final bar is once again that breakdown of where the Pell Grant money is coming from, where Pell Grant money is distributed, and so where that surplus is coming from in the state grant formula. So once again, I think just, you know, as we look at all of this information and kind of soak in what we feel the intent of that's the stimulative purposes of sending the Pell Grant money out was to put that money into the hands of students, and we believe that any increase to the LME is going to be the most representative distribution of that money as far as where it came from.
Yeah.
Mr. Allen.
Yeah, and I think generally, you know, it's something that the committees and the conference committees have recognized in the past that with the recognized price by the Office of Higher Education of the living and miscellaneous expenses, basically what the non-academic costs that a student has to spend to go to school, are roughly about $10,000. And currently, the maximum you could get, depending on your financial need, is $6,200 for your living expenses. And you know, so that's a pretty substantial gap. And one thing that the committees have worked on in the past couple of years is raising that living and miscellaneous expense to get closer to what the recognized cost is for students that go to school. And so for the last several years, our associations have tried to work committee members to try to increase that as much as possible and for a variety of different reasons. One, because there is that such a substantial gap between the cost and what the maximum they can get for that. And also, too, because oftentimes when it comes with pulling the levers of the financial aid system, there are quote-unquote winners and losers. Some students get more money, some students get less money. One of the reasons that we've been supporting the LME increase is because it is an equal distribution no matter where you go to school. So you can go to Carleton, you could go to Inver Grove, you could go to St. Cloud State. And depending on your financial need, you would get the same amount of increase from an LME. So if money was put in there. So that's one of our rationale, at least, for bringing this forward and trying to make the case that with a lot of different levers that you pull, some people do a little bit better than others, but the LME seems to be and has been recognized as the fairest distribution. You know, and fairest, I guess, is obviously very subjective, but the most equal distribution no matter where a student goes to school.
Any questions for
Iskup?
Okay, yes, Senator Roebling.
I'm wondering if you add together then, if we would put more of the money on the LME, and you added together the Pell Grant and the state grant, would there be instances where we would exceed the cost of tuition and fees?
My understanding from all of the explanations that I've gotten from the Office of Higher Education of the state grant formula is the money that comes from the state grant is last in, and so they will not go above what your budget is, which includes tuition and fees and then the living and miscellaneous expense.
Which means no.
Then it would go above. It would go above tuition and fees.
Just tuition and fees, yes. If you include the
Sir Allen.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you could potentially get more than just your tuition and fees. The living and miscellaneous expense is kind of a grant based on your income or your parents' income to supplement all the other costs associated with college. So technically you could say you could get more than your tuition and fees, but the reason you're getting more is because of your living costs. And for other things, if you have dependents, you could potentially get child care assistance, work study, you could apply, you could be eligible for that. And there's a couple of other, the GI Bill would be another additional thing that you could get.
Interesting.
At some point I would like to see how that works, because, of course, it would mainly apply probably to the two-year institutions where the tuition and fees were the lowest. So they could potentially get quite a bit of extra money for living in miscellaneous. And I would kind of like to know how that is, because in my philosophy of life, I don't mind helping students with tuition and fees, but they really shouldn't be distinguished with that much from the rest of the population so that they don't have to cover their own living expenses. And the IRS doesn't allow you to do that either, because the state of Minnesota and the federal government tax amounts that are over the cost of tuition and fees. Because they're saying we need to treat you like everybody else in the population, and if you get that income, you will be taxed on it, because if you were working for it, you would be taxed on it too. And so I would like to see from somebody, if we put this all on living in miscellaneous, how many schools, if you got the full Pell Grant and the full state grant, how many would end up giving any substantial amount above the tuition and fee costs?
Madam Chair?
Representative Cavina.
Senator Roebling, I don't think either of these proposals talks about putting everything on in the LME. We tried to have a good mix of, whether it was tuition caps or LME or reducing the student share, and in your case, the assigned family program, and, child care grants, work study. We haven't put everything, and I don't think anybody proposes to do that, but we do have a significant difference in you into what we did put in and what we went up to. But I don't know if what you said there was accurate as far as you're talking about getting information on taxes.
I know that's accurate.
Well, maybe.
Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, members, the state grant is not taxable, whether it's above your tuition and fees or not. That we've had this discussion 2 years ago. I think you're talking about potentially scholarship and military money. I don't remember which, but the state grant money above what your tuition and fees would be is not taxable that way.
What about if you get like some colleges would provide institutional aid to cover your living expenses?
Madam Chair,
I don't believe that's taxable.
Not institutional aid certainly would not be. I'm not sure that I can think of any aid that would be.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling. I just did my college son's taxes, and he had a very good scholarship, and we had to claim everything above tuition and fees that were not paid directly to the institution, so that the money that came to him for covering his rent and food costs
what was all taxable.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Berg.
Senator, I believe that the operative thing here is scholarship. That was not a state grant, was it?
It was not a state grant. It was a scholarship. But
state grants do not operate the same way, and they are not taxable above tuition.
Somebody have their cell phone by the mic or something? Might have to move it. Does anyone in the audience want to add anything to this discussion? Has any information about... Yes, why don't you come forward? We're interested in hearing what you think. Also, if you have an opinion about whether the state grant should cover living expenses, which I believe it does currently for low-income students.
Madam Chair, Peter Zetterberg, University of Minnesota.
Mr. Zetterberg.
I would like to say that the University of Minnesota would strongly encourage you to consider the governor's proposal, which was put together by staff of the Office of Higher Education. We believe it's the most balanced proposal. We believe it best recognizes the cost differences among Minnesota higher educational institutions, which was a basic principle of the state grant program when it was first put together. The state grant program is not designed to give all students the same size Pell and State Grant award. It works very differently intentionally than the Pell Grant program does. It does recognize cost of attendance. There are two things in particular, being very direct, Representative Rupert, that we do not like about the House proposal. The first is that it provides an increase only in the first year of the biennium, while costs for students are going to go up in both years of the biennium. The governor's proposal recognizes that and provides an increase for all students, not just in the first year of the biennium, but also in the second. The second thing that we'd encourage you not to do that's in the House proposal is extend eligibility to 10 semesters. Frankly, I could argue both sides of that, but on balance, we would rather have the money, a greater amount of money going to students during their first 4 years of study. The best way for students to control the cost of their education is to graduate in 4 years. The state universities, the University of Minnesota, the private colleges are called four-year institutions for a reason. You should get in and out in 4 years. Staying a fifth year or a sixth year costs students a tremendous amount. The state grant program limits eligibility to 8 semesters because it recognizes that fact, and we do believe it would be a mistake to change that and extend eligibility.
Mr. Zetterberg, I believe for 1 year we extended it for a couple semesters, 1 or 2 semesters, I don't remember.
That's correct, Senator Patterson.
Was that too short a period of time to get any...
I believe so. It was for 1 year only,
right.
And I don't think it was possible to do any kind of analysis whether or not that was a good change or best. But there's no doubt about the fact that all students in their first 4 years of study, regardless of the institution they attend, would be better off if they were getting more money during that period than if it was somewhat diluted by putting it some of it with students who are in their fifth year of study.
Okay.
Senator Lass.
Mr. Zetterberg, would the logic then be that if they get more support in the first 4 years, they're less likely to have to work to make up the difference and can spend more of their time taking classes that will help them graduate in 4 years?
Senator Pappas, Senator Lass, that's absolutely true. It's also likely that they would borrow less.
Okay.
Representative Haas.
What type of statistics do you have now in comparison with this economic time where we're having the students are having a struggle of how many are actually graduating in 4 years as compared to, say, 4 or 5 years ago?
Mr. Zetterberg.
Senator Pappas, Representative Haas. At the University of Minnesota, the four-year graduation rate is as high as it's ever been. Nearly two-thirds of our students who graduate in 4 years. We have done many things over the past 4 or 5 years to encourage that. We require all students to register for a minimum of 13 credits each term. We limit our own scholarships to 4 years of eligibility, and we constantly preach the importance of trying to finish in 4 years. spending an additional fifth year or an additional sixth year is extremely costly to a student. It's not just the cost during that fifth year or during that sixth year. There are deferred earnings that an individual will never make up in their lifetime. And we do believe limiting eligibility for the state grant program to 8 semesters does send an important message and does reinforce that message.
Well, Representative Rukavina.
And Mr. Sederberg, and I have to compliment you because you've come up with some good ideas to motivate students, you know, and your discount, I guess, for lack of a better word, if you took more credits. But by your own admission, a third of your students aren't graduating in 4 years, and in the different four-year Minscu system, you have a lot of students that are non-traditional students that have to work and have to maybe have a family to take care of even, or have transferred from a two-year institution that, so, you know, there's a different mix. And, you know, it's been rather disturbing to me, and I've talked to, some of your folks that hang around the Capitol here that, and I don't know if I'm the only one, but I don't think I am, where my constituents call me up and say, what's going on at the University of Minnesota? My daughter or son is a straight-A student. They're active in the Honor Society and sports and whatever, and they can't get into the University of Minnesota. So I check to see, and your number in freshman, Minnesota freshmen being admitted into the University of Minnesota, all the campuses, is going down every year steadily since, I believe, 2002, and I have those numbers somewhere. So, you know, maybe you're culling the herd here, so to speak. Maybe you're picking and cherry picking, because if my students who, you know, and we, you know I'm not the brightest bulb in the tree, but I don't think I'm that dumb. And I think a lot of my constituents' children are pretty sharp, and they can't get accepted. So maybe you're getting those brilliant students because you're cherry-picking, and even then, you can't graduate. Only two-thirds of your students in 4 years. So if I'm being rather direct, I apologize, because I like you. You know, you've been a pretty good guy and a pretty good resource, but you know, I think that this 10-semester idea deserves a good looking at.
Senator Pappas, Representative Rukavina, there is language in the House bill regarding the enrollment of Minnesota residents that we would like to address at some other point in time. I'll simply point out that we have more Minnesota residents enrolled at the University of Minnesota this year than we did back in 2006-07, which is a benchmark year in the House bill. But back to the state grant program, I understand that there are many students who work. Nearly 80% of our students who attend the University of Minnesota do work. They still manage to graduate in 4 years, and they are still better off because of it. So I am simply giving you the position of the University of Minnesota. Again, we would strongly encourage you to consider the governor's proposal with what to do as a way of passing on the increase in the Pell Grant money.
Could somebody remind us from staff or Mr. Michikanis what the governor's proposal was and how it differs? I think the Senate bill is closer to the governor's proposal. Am I right with that? Mr. Albrecht, did you want to do that, or Mr. Michikanis, who wants to do it?
I can do
it. Okay, Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and members, the governor's proposal was to increase the LME $372 in the first year and $394 in the second year. The governor increases the two-year tuition maximum to $6,244 in the first year and then $6,712 in the second year. And the governor increases the four-year tuition max to $10,576 in the first year and $11,369 in the second year.
I missed it because he was talking to me.
Madam Chair, the governor increases LME and the tuition maximums.
He does those, just those two.
That's correct.
So that's the philosophy then, Mr. Zetterberg, the same, is that those are the two areas that need to be addressed, and that the other stuff, extra semesters or assigned family responsibility or student share, are priced a little closer to what they should be? Mr. Connors, is that what you would say?
Madam Chair, getting back to this price issue, just so the Conference Committee has a sense of our rationale for the numbers that Mr. Oliver just mentioned. Essentially, there's a 6% increases in LME and 7.5% on the tuition and fee maximums. We do both the 4 and the 2-year because we think that's consistent. The reasons that the percentages are different is that it was our observation that the tuition caps had not kept up with inflation as well as the LME had. So we felt it more appropriate to benefit the tuition side of it as opposed to the LME side.
Madam Chair, I'd like to add one more comment about that. What you don't see when you just look at the increases in the LME or the increases in the tuition maximum is the fact that there will also be increases for all students in Minsku because the program still continues to recognize their full tuition amount. So their combined Pell Grant and State Grant award is going to go up regardless of how you increase the LME, regardless of what you do with the tuition maximum, simply because their tuition and fees are going to increase next year. The State Grant program, unfortunately, as of just this year, no longer recognizes University of Minnesota tuition and fees.
There is a Ripson Haas.
Thank you. I would like to do a follow-up question on a third of the students that are not graduating after 4 years. Is there any statistics or analysis that I could look at that would determine how many of those are just disappearing, maybe why they're disappearing, how many are graduating after a semester and wouldn't need the 10th semester but might need the 9th semester? Are we losing a lot of those people by not finishing up because they no longer have a grant? Is there anything I can look at to study that issue a little bit longer? Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas, Representative Hawes, the third of the students I'm talking about are the third who do eventually graduate, but who take 5 or 6 years to do it. And one of the things I can tell you about the students who take 5 years and 6 years to do it is that they borrow more, and a higher percentage of them use loan programs. There is sort of a myth that a lot of students take 5 and 6 years to graduate in order to avoid using loan programs and borrowing money, but it is absolutely not true. The students who graduate in 4 years, a smaller percentage borrow, and their loan indebtedness is less than it is for students who graduate in 5 years. And the percentage of students who borrow and their average loan and debt indebtedness is greater for students who graduate in 6 years than it is for students who graduate in 5 years. Again, I believe we have not done enough to convey to students and families the financial advantages of graduating in 4 years, regardless of which kind of four-year institution you attend, and we need to do more.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What about the argument that the students have made that the Pell Grant increase that Congress passed was intended for Pell Grant recipient students? And I know we're doing that in the Senate bill. We're using the money to fix some problems that the state grant study identified. But is it more appropriate, and I'm trying to articulate their position, that we use the dollars for as almost more like a pass-through to the Pell Grant eligible students? Because under our bill and the governor's bill, more of that money gets kind of spread around to students who some may be eligible for Pell Grant and some may not.
Senator Pappas, I can only give you my opinion on that. And I would simply point out that there were many years when the Pell Grant remained flat, when the state of Minnesota was picking up the federal government share. It still continued to increase the combined award every year. And for that very reason, I think the state has considerable discretion in exactly how it decides to pass those additional federal dollars on.
Senator Sharon would really like to be on this conference committee. She's really torn with Health and Human Services. And since I'm opening up, normally I wouldn't let someone who isn't on the conference committee, but since we're kind of opening it up in general to the public, if it's okay with the House members, when Senator Sharon's here, I'd like to allow her to comment. Senator Sharon. Yes.
Thank you very much. The thing I'm trying to wrap my head around is, if LME can be used to pay tuition as well as a broader scope of utilization, why would the institutions who would be advocating for increase on the cap for tuition, when you lay that out, it appears as though there is not the same distribution and access to those dollars that there would be if we used so what's confusing to me is why you speak against using LME when that can in and of itself fill that gap as tuition increases no matter which system the student is applying to. Why that's important.
Mr. Zetterberg.
Yeah, Senator Pappas, there is actually a very significant difference. If you were to increase only the LME, and neither the Senate bill or the House bill proposes doing that, but if you were to do just that, then every student would get exactly the same, then it's not the case that every student gets exactly the same dollar increase. What doesn't show up on your worksheets is the fact that students in Minsku and also in the two-year privates who are still below the tuition maximums will see an additional increase because their tuition and fees are going up. So if you were to take that approach, in effect, the combined increase in the Pell and State Grant Award for students in Minsku and in those two-year privates that are still below the tuition cap would be a greater dollar amount than it would be for students at the University of Minnesota and that it would be for students in the state's four-year private colleges.
You and I have to leave, but I was wondering, you know, if we could just pick a member each to be our co-chairs as we leave, and that maybe we could walk through, instead of the financial stuff, maybe walk through some of the policy differences that when you and I are gone.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to appoint Senator Lynch to take my place, and the advice I'm giving her is that if she knows that these are particular Senate provisions in which I've been involved in, she can just skip over those.
How about any that Senator Lynch has been particularly involved in?
She could talk about those. Although if House members have questions and the other conferees feel like they need to wait for me, then that's fine. Same thing with provisions that are of concern to you. I could just skip over.
I put Representative McFarland, but I'm afraid she'd accept the governor's proposal. So I'll take Representative Haas, since he's my senior member. I think he's got seniority by a year over the rest of my members, so... Representative Haas, will you promise not to do anything just for St. Cloud while I'm gone?
It was a silent promise.
Then Slocum, would you come up here?
Madam Chair,
changing chairs right now.
Before I move on, something even more important, dinner. This was going to be our dinner break. What do you anticipate we should do for dinner? You're going to go straight through.
Well, Madam Chair, I was hoping we could break by at least like 5:30 because my staff has to eat too to go to the next committee at 6:30, which we're going till about 10 tonight. So then you could eat dinner, Senator Latson. You look, you're nice and skinny. You better eat dinner.
I better eat.
Bulk up for the rest of the
time. I don't care when. Whatever the procedure is fine with me, just as long as we have time.
Welcome. I think, as Senator Pappas mentioned, we'll just continue working through, and we'll try to get additional information on the various provisions in both proposals. Can we move on, and maybe looking at our chart here, there are the next big sort of subgroup is the one titled Other State Grant Provisions. Maybe to just get us kicked off in this direction, one of the House provisions that Senate has no position on is with regard to the FAFSA application requirement. Okay, and we will, under the state grant programs, it's apparent that there are a number of provisions that I think it's best that we have Representative Rukavina, frankly, and Senator Pappas are going to want to weigh in, I think, pretty heavily in those areas. And so it's my suggestion then that we move on page 2 under scholarships and other financial aid. We have... Okay. I think they're testing me. No, we're gonna wait on a chief for Senator Pappas. So now I'm on page 4.
Thank you.
The first item there is a Senate position on ICAP. Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and members, this is a rider to the appropriation for the ICAP program that that asks the Office of Higher Education to continue funding the organizations that receive grants in the current biennium in order to gather enough data to permit a more sophisticated analysis of the results of the various programs.
Madam Chair,
The
House's position is we fund it, but we don't give any additional direction.
Any questions from members? Okay. We'll move on to the power of you. Some changes there, Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair, the Senate position changes the power of you from being a program that the system has to run to a program that it may run if the board decides to continue it.
And Madam Chair,
no left.
The House's position is that we fund the existing program and we also additionally expand it to 2 pilot programs. Which are also funded in the House bill. And the 2 pilot programs are one in a suburban area and one in a rural area.
And Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Where does the money come for the expansion?
Out of our target, Madam Chair.
The house, to I guess go back to where maybe you're heading, the Achieve program in the governor's bill is scaled back from its base. The Senate alters that program somewhat, and the House deletes it.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, which is one of my concerns. The Achieve program is a program that benefits students statewide that are eligible if they meet the criteria of taking the right preparatory courses for college, whereas the Power of You program is for a smaller, much smaller group of eligible students. It isn't based necessarily on academics or even income, I don't think. It's anybody who lives within Minneapolis or St. Paul and attended a school here was able to get some money for it. Isn't that how the Power of You has been set up in the past?
Madam Chair, I do think they have to be a state grant, Pell Grant eligible, but it was specifically to a locality also. And Madam Chair, I think Minsky had made some comments on what they would like to, if this was going to go in, where they would like to see them. So maybe they would like to comment if there's somebody here that wishes to.
I'd invite Minsky to come forward if they'd like to comment on Power of You. And members, as we go along through these provisions, by all means, as you have questions, let us know. But we'll just keep going on.
Oh, they wanted us to.
Is there someone from Minsky that wishes to comment on the Power of You?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Welcome to the 2009 Conference Committee. Delighted to be here. The Power of You program is a program that we're very interested in seeing continue. We think it has shown promising performance, and we're grateful for the language in the House bill that recognizes it and, in fact, expands it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
At the loss of the scholarship money for Achieve?
Madam Chair, we're not linking the support for the program to how it's financed. So I would leave the Achieve debate to members.
I think some of those questions are going to be more, we'll be better positioned to be able to make some of those decisions once Senator Pappas and Representative Rukavina come up with our targets. And that might help us in getting to where we need to get. So, but your point is well taken, Senator Roebling. I mean, at some point we're going to have to entertain discussions like this. But for now, it's probably helpful to just get everything out on the table and have an understanding. If there's nothing further on the Power of You, we'll move on. Technical and Community College Emergency Grants for Students. This is a House provision.
Madam Chair, this is a new grant that is funded through a transfer from appropriations to the Office of Higher Education to individual Minsky campuses to provide emergency grants to students attending those two-year campuses to prevent the students from having to drop out of school. It's kind of a stopgap grant program. Say that four times. to recognize the difficult economic times that we're in.
Senator Erickson-Ropes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if the House members could expand a little bit more on that. Has there been some problems, or what sort of statistics do we have from across the state that would give me some indication of how big a problem it is? Is there somebody that got in trouble with last year and had to drop out after 1 year of a two-year education, or what happened?
I wonder if there are, Senator Erickson, well, perhaps there are some students that would like to provide some background for us on that.
Well, Madam Chair, members, Jacob Wheeler with Minnesota State College Student Association. As far as, like, specific, any case that may have led to this provision being put in there, I don't know that. But I do know anecdotally from campus experience that there have been a number of times at Mesabi Range where I attend that students have come either to the Student Senate or to other student groups on campus, such as our Human Services Club, and asked for emergency loans that would help them either be able to cover rent that month or pay for fuel so that they can get to class. And I think, you know, as we see these kind of tough economic times with the number of layoffs that are going on, with the number of people that are being forced out of work, there may be students who are attending part-time, working full-time, get laid off from their job, and they may not be able to finish the semester without, you know, a couple hundred dollars to cover fuel costs, transportation costs. And again, I don't have any specific stories, but anecdotally, I have had a number of students on campus in the last couple of years who have approached various student groups with that exact situation.
So the emergency grants would be targeted to the non-academic expenses?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, as far as my understanding of the provision is, it was for any to cover any expenses that would prevent the student from being able to finish the semester. And the general idea would be that the student has already probably covered their tuition and fees and books because it's midway through the semester, all of that's already been covered, and some unforeseen event occurs that could lead to them not being able to finish out that term or finish out their program. And in order to prevent that, there would be some sort of funds available for them to cover those emergency expenses.
Representative Hawes, did the House have any discussion or provide any specific criteria to what the eligibility requirements would be or how the funds would be distributed or what threshold would have to be met?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Fine.
This is a program that existed in the 1980s during the economic crisis. And it was a program that was brought to the legislature by the then chancellor of the technical college system because they had a number of students who, you know, they would suddenly have a car breakdown, they could no longer attend class, and they were either going to drop out or someone had to help them cover that cost. And so Chair Rukavina thought that it would be a good time to kind of start that up again, given that we have a lot of students who are barely able to survive in school right now. They've lost their jobs, and they're back, and they have no money. And that this would be a discretionary program for financial aid people, and they get a small pot of money at any school. And if somebody came in who was in dire circumstances and couldn't stay, that they could get this. So it's kind of an experiment in that sense to see if it does what it's supposed to do.
From my understanding, that when it was enacted in the 1980s, that it was successful at that time. And again, it is a program that would go away, you know, when times are a little bit better. But right now, there is students that if any hardship is going to take them out of their potential educational cycle.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lax.
Both this program and the power of you funding, it says, were paid for by a money transfer from the Office of Higher Education. Could I ask for clarification? Does that come out of their administrative line, or is some other pot of money that ordinarily be administered by them? Or?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Novak.
The money is appropriated specifically to the Office of Higher Education in the bill for a transfer to the Office of Higher from the Office of Higher Education to Minsky or the Minsky campuses.
Okay, so it's not...
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, it's not money being taken out of OHE's operations. It's,
that's okay. Correct. Senator Letts.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking back at how they would apply for this, and, you know, like if somebody's transmission went out and it's going to cost $1,000, how would you be able to give them the whole $1,000, but then you know you're going to run out even before the end of the semester for any other requests? I'm just trying to figure out how exactly it would be administered so that there would be some fairness and opportunity for additional students, or some could get a big benefit and others not get much at all.
Madam
Chair. Ms. Nowak.
I believe the language is permissive in the House bill, and it would allow the financial aid officers at the campuses to make those decisions and determinations. There is no additional direction other than a small rider.
Any further questions on this provision from members? Okay. We will move on then to the Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program, a House provision.
Madam Chair, this also creates a new loan forgiveness program administered by the Office of Higher Education. This is a bill in the House by Representative Otremba. The focus of the bill is to increase the number of veterinarians who are practicing in rural areas on large animals or feed animals. And it's a relatively small program. There's only a maximum of 5 recipients a year who would be eligible for it. And it limits annual loan payments to $15,000 or less each year for 5 years.
Questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roblin.
In the spreadsheet here, it looks like there's only an appropriation for 2010. But it's up to 5 years they can get the benefit, and it's all supposed to come out of that one appropriation. Is that how it's set up?
Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I believe the payments would actually be delayed after 2010 because the loan forgiveness wouldn't kick in until the students had graduated and were in their practice. So I think that just establishes a pool of money that would be available then when they're actually eligible for loan forgiveness.
Are there, it might be helpful, I think there are, there are some other areas that we offer loan forgiveness in, and it might be helpful to have a list pulled together of what those various areas are, so we just have that information for consideration as we move forward.
Madam Chair, I think I would note that,
Representative House.
Thank you very much. I think not only for the student, but for the area that they're working in and the need of the veterinarian in that area, which is stressing the economic development of, or the lack of, when the veterinarian is not there for taking care of the animals.
Would the Office of Higher Education care to comment on this provision? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure why we don't have a Senate position, because it seems to me that we did hear this bill in the Senate Ag Committee. Senator Dill was carrying this, and as many of you know, he is a veterinarian himself. He made a pretty convincing presentation to our committee about the need for large animal veterinarians serving the rural area. The problem amongst veterinarians is not the small animal practices. There's plenty of them. They tend to be lots situated to live in a metro ring and even a rural area. But for the large animal veterinarians that serve primarily the agriculture community, it's very difficult to get people to take up that specialty and then serve the rural area. And I do recall as well, there have to be designated high needs areas that the students would agree to work in order to qualify for the loan forgiveness.
Madam Chair?
Before I call on you, Mrs. Grimes, I want to just offer clarification that the question was asked if the Senate had this provision somewhere else, and this is not a provision that the Senate has in its ag bill. Just for clarification.
Ms. Grimes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. You asked about other loan forgiveness programs. With state money, the ones that come to mind are have to do with doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, and are administered and funded through the health department. The language as written for large animal veterinarians is structured very similarly to those programs at the health department. The Office of Higher Education does have a concern about the fact that the language does not provide for administrative funds, and while the program would only serve a small number of students, there still would be forms that need to be set up, accounting that would need to be tracked to make sure that we are good stewards of the state's money and so forth. We are currently in discussions with the Department of Health to try to find out what it costs them to administer their programs that are rather similar, to try to get you an estimate of that amount.
Ms. Grimes, I think that would be helpful. So would this be the only loan forgiveness program that is administered by OAG?
Madam Chair, currently, yes. In the past, there were some loan programs for medical and osteopaths and optometrists that I believe we might still be administering the last 3 or 4 years from 15 to 20 years ago, but this would be the only new program.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lax.
I remember, I think 2 years ago, we heard a proposal for a nursing loan forgiveness program, but I don't recall that it was passed. Was it passed? I think there were funding issues. And we heard them for legal services as well, for public defenders and for civil legal aid.
Madam Chair, there have been nursing programs proposed a number of times in the past. They tend to be expansions of or different kinds of loan forgiveness for certain kinds of nursing practice or practice in certain areas. There are some, though, already operating and have been for many years through the Department of Health. There have been, I believe, twice over the years that some loan forgiveness for lawyers practicing in the area of public interest law, so forth, have been proposed, and I believe both times those were vetoed by the governor at that time. And that one of them is many, many years ago, and one of them is more recent.
It looks like the Department of Health has joined us. Mr. Schoenbaum, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members, Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. We do and have long administered health professional loan forgiveness programs that were created by the legislature in the early 1990s, or perhaps before. They were originated with the Office of Higher Education, but they were all transferred to the Health Department in the early to mid 1990s. You may have some vestiges, but I believe we have them all.
Right.
There are, I believe, six professions in the loan forgiveness program administered on an ongoing basis. They include physicians who agree to practice in rural or urban underserved areas, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and nurse midwives who agree to practice in rural areas, pharmacists who agree to practice in rural areas, dentists who agree to see public programs, patients, I'm going to come up short here, but there are a variety, and nurses, registered nurses and LPNs who agree to work in nursing homes or facilities for the developmentally disabled, ICFMRs.
Pharmacists
who agree to practice in rural areas. And there is state appropriation in the health department's base for those programs. As was noted, the language for the veterinarian program that you are considering is modeled after those health professional loan forgiveness programs. And as was also mentioned, we are in conversations with the Office of Higher Education about costs and perhaps the efficiency of, if this were to be enacted, some interagency ability for us to use our infrastructure to do that. But we're just early in those conversations.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
One thing we have considered is that if this language were to pass, we might try to do an interagency agreement where the appropriation would be made to the Office of Higher Education, but the actual administration of the program might be done at the Department of Health in order to take advantage of their existing expertise in very similar programs.
Additional questions from members? Okay. Thank you very much. The next item is the United Family Medicine, and I'm going to ask that we skip over that item at this time and continue on to page 5. Reciprocity, residency, definition, and appeal process. Ms. Novak.
Both the Senate and the House have identical language, I believe, for this provision, which was a proposal in the governor's bill. It changes, or it creates a definition of residency for the reciprocity program, the tuition reciprocity program, and also establishes an appeal process for students who have been denied status as a Minnesota resident.
Thank you. I think we could, we have a real opportunity here. We could make Representative Rukavina and Senator Pappas both equally nervous if we can announce to them when they return to the room that we have made a decision and have decided to adopt.
What do you want to do with it?
This provision. Well, you know, Representative Bosch, I think as a Senate chair that we should take the House language.
The Senate language. I'm hope the governor is all right with us.
So I'm feeling like we're making progress, members. The next item. Senator Roebling, please.
Madam Chair, I move that we take the House language for. Which section, Ms. Novak?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, it would be on page R36, House language, sections 5 and 6.
No. Mr. Albrecht.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's not.
That's the appeal in the House language.
There's a little difference on 6.
Oh, okay.
We're under pressure here now.
To Section 5?
To Section 5, I guess.
Will we take Section 5 and adopt that?
Senator Roebling has moved that we adopt Section 5 of the House language. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The provision is adopted. We could really impress them if we desired to further discuss Section 6 and resolve that what appears to be almost a small technical matter. Mr. Albrecht?
I have extra.
Madam Chair and members, on the Senate side of that provision on page R37, on line 27.14, it says that the director may grant resident status for the purpose of this section, and I believe the House language does not have that particular phrase.
Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair, I believe the House would be fine with the Senate language. At the staff level.
Move the Senate language.
Representative Haas moves the Senate language on 37. Section 10, sub 9. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's adopted. Thank you, members. Okay. I feel we're on a roll. Maybe we should jump to something fun. Yeah. the next provision on page 5, the self-loans obligation, similar provisions. Mr. Albrecht?
Madam Chair, this is language also that came in the governor's bill that Senator Roebling had in the Senate, and it includes language for the Office of Higher Education to certify to the governor whether or not there would be money needed in order to meet the bonding obligations in the self-loan program. And the governor would then have to, if there were an expectation that money would be needed, the governor would have to include money for that provision in his budget recommendation. There's no obligation on the part of the legislature to actually act on whatever the governor decides or has to include in his budget recommendation.
Questions from members? I'm going to move on if I don't see a Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair, it seems that the language is very similar. What is the difference? So then maybe we could talk about the difference between it and perhaps even resolve that. It seems like that's small. Mm-hmm. Could be a small
matter.
No significant difference. Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair, the differences are minor and stylistic is how I would characterize them. The Senate's bill is organized in two subdivisions. The House's bill is organized in two paragraphs. The House changed the head note of Section 12 to make it descriptive that it was the self-loan revenue bonds that were being described in the section. The Senate repeats some words in the clauses, but these are all stylistic changes that could be resolved easily.
Senator Roebling.
Actually, the House language shortens it up just a little bit by the way they do it, by putting if any in paragraph A, and then it's not repeated over and over. So I think we could accept the House language. It saves a few words in the book.
Senator Erickson Ropes on that point.
Madam Chair, I was just going to suggest something similar, that if they're that close, we should just perhaps consider adopting some language on this too.
Madam Chair and members of the Conference, Mark Miscanis for Office of Education. There was two things that I wanted to raise, except for, aside from the status of changes that Ms. Novak mentioned. Earlier in the session, Mr. Albert called me and requested a change, and this would be on the Senate side on line 32.29, adding with governor's budget.
Mr. Miscanis, can you direct us to what page and what line
it's
you're on?
It's on page R43, line 32.29. I think the word governor's there was at that point significant to the Senate. And then on line, again, I'll work from the Senate side. On line 32.25, there's a reference to debt service fund. Our attorneys have seen this, and they feel we need the word reserve after service. So it would be debt service reserve fund, which I think might have been in the original language and missing along the way.
Excuse me?
Yeah. Mr. Fuller.
Wasn't going to talk to you. Hello. I think we can combine the two of them if they're significant. We'll take the House language and just line 32.
On the House side.
On the House side, 24.13. On the debt service reserve, 24.14, I'm sorry. Yeah, reserve for fund. And then line 24.18 before budget. Insert governors. Move House language as amended.
Senator Roebling, would you like to make that motion to adopt the House language with those two oral amendments?
I so move, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Two members. That was the adoption of section, House Section 11 and 12 on R43. All right, we will move on to Safety Officer Survivor. Would the House care to comment? Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair, the House, this is part of the financial aid package changes of the House bill. It also adds the two additional semesters of eligibility to the Safety Officer Survivor Grant Program.
Mr. Albrecht?
And Madam Chair, on the Senate side, the award under that program would be made available to a student who is attending a school in a reciprocity state or a state that that Minnesota has a reciprocity agreement with.
Is there anyone in the audience that cares to comment on this provision? Questions from members? OHE Administration. Mr. Albrecht.
Well, the administrative money.
Anything that we discuss today, we, with the exception of the things that we've adopted, there will be opportunities if Senator Pappas or Representative Rukavina feel that we have overlooked something, or they'll have the opportunity to speak to any of the items that we're going through tonight. Ms. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and members, in the Senate bill for the Office of Higher Education's administration budget, the Senate does include language that gives them money to administer both the Atif Scholarship Program and the Indian Scholarship Programs.
Ms. Novak.
Madam Chair, I believe the House also includes administration, but it's in as a part of their general appropriation.
Madam Chair, I would just comment that the House has the $75,000 for administering the Indian scholarships. The House bill does not include the Achieve program, and there's no language in the bill that relates to that.
Appreciate the clarification.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Just to note, I did notice a difference in the amount that each was appropriating. The Senate had $2.519 million and the House has $2.685 for agency administration. So there's about $160,000 or so difference.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, if you look, there's a number of differences. The Senate essentially takes the governor's administrative reduction at the Office of Higher Education as a single line, allowing the office to allocate the programs in administration how they choose. The House did not make any of those reductions, but did eliminate the administration for the Achieve program since the House canceled the Achieve program.
And Senator
Albrecht,
I'm guessing that another part of the difference might be that in the House bill, the $75,000 for the Indian scholarship is on different lines.
And members, I can say with a high degree of confidence that this will be one of those areas that we will be having much more discussion on, and just sort of to begin that discussion. The TEACH program, it's on page R5, pretty self-explanatory. questions from members? Representative Hawes?
I would like to call on Representative Bly.
Representative Bly?
Yes. This is a program to help early childhood teachers gain better training and hopefully a higher wage when they go in their workplace. It's been a successful program. There is a difference in the House and Senate position. The House has one-time funding, and the Senate has ongoing funding. The House increases the funding by, I think it's $50,000 each year.
Thank you. Questions from members? Senator Erickson.
So this particular item, Madam Chair, it's just a funding difference. The policy is similar or identical. Is that right?
Representative Bly.
I think the policy is the same. There is someone in the audience who could speak to the program if you'd like to.
Madam Chair, if we're okay on the policy, I don't know that we need to talk about the policy or the program. The funding piece is the only thing separating us,
correct.
Right? I'm okay to pass on the policy.
Welcome to the committee. You identify yourself for the chair, particularly.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann McCulley. I'm the Executive Director of the Child Care Resource and Referral Network. We're the program or the agency that administers the program. And appreciate the opportunity. We're thrilled to see that this is in both sides. Obviously, we would prefer the Senate position in terms of continuing the funding in the base. When this was added to statute in 2007, it was put into the base. So, for what that's worth, we appreciate seeing that continue. Just quickly, this effectively doubles the number of scholarships we can give to child care providers in the state, increasing from our federal dollars that we receive for child care with higher ed dollars. And with the advent of the quality rating and improvement system, this legislature is hopefully going to pass in some other bills, we are already seeing an increase in the number of providers who wish to come back and get their AA or their BA degree. Professional development is one of the measures in that quality rating system. So the ability to anticipate beyond a biennium would be extremely helpful to the program.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
Just so I'm getting what you're understanding, rather than the increase of the $50,000, you would be preference for the ongoing dollars. Is that what you're?
I think I'm hearing.
Ms. McCulley,
Madam Chair, and Representative Hawes, I think if it's that's the trade-off, I think the ongoing nature would be of the most interest. Yes.
Senator Roebling. Thank you, Madam Chair. If people are coming for their AA or BA degrees, are they also eligible? They would be eligible for other Pell and state grant money as well, right?
Correct. Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, that we do work with the other financial aid that's available, and so if they have other financial aid, we build on top of that, but sometimes people are not eligible for that, and so we try to be that sort of lender of last resort, specifically for early childhood.
Anything further? Ms. McCulley, thank you. Members, I'm going to suggest we are now at the part where we have Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the University of Minnesota, and it's my suggestion that it would be a better use of our time if we went through those two particular areas, I think, with Senator Pappas and Representative Lukavina. And so I would like to redirect us to page 11 in the document. Won't they be impressed when they walk back in the room and we're on page 11? So just smile, okay? On page 11, under Other Access Programs, we'll begin with the PSEO marketing information. This is a Senate position. This is something that the chair thought would be helpful in trying to do a better job of letting our high school students know of opportunities that currently exist. I don't know if
anybody wants to add anything more to that, that's really kind of what the heart of the matter is with this provision.
Chair?
Senator Roblin.
And it wasn't my provision, but I do think it's a good idea. What we were trying to do is, in the past, there's been a prohibition saying that the schools come in to talk to students about starting PSEO classes, that they really couldn't talk about the financial benefit of doing that. And there is a huge financial benefit to students to taking several of these college credit courses in high school, so that they, which are fully paid for under PSEO, so that later on when they enter college, they already have some of those out of the way. They have some credits in reserve already, which certainly helps meet the four-year graduation and make that more attainable. And I don't know why the prohibition was put in there in the first place, but maybe there was a fear when the PSEO programs were initially started that they didn't want, you know, there could have been a lobbying group that said we don't want this marketed too heavily. We'll see how it goes first. So now we see how it goes, and I think we can market it as much as we want and should market it a lot, because it could save students a lot of time and money. And so I think it's probably time to remove the prohibition.
Is there anyone in the audience that would care to comment on this provision? Senator Erickson Robles.
Madam Chair, just thinking about some of the conversation we've had in our committee to let the House members know. You know, as we're trying to really look at this seamless method of delivering education from P16 or P18 or P20 now, we actually can say, we just thought it was a good thing to be promoting the fact that kids can take these PSEO classes. So, you know, we're moving that direction anyway, trying to get kids in early and have them move seamlessly through the system, but there should not be any roadblocks. And I was surprised to find out that actually there had been some sort of instruction in the past not to talk about some benefits. I mean, why would you not talk about benefits? I mean, if you're going to offer a program, either talk about the benefits or don't offer the program. Yeah, it just seemed a little funny to say we have PSEO out there, but don't talk about it. So it just is a common sense strategy, I think.
Representative Black.
I think when these programs were instituted, it was the Privilege Administration that that promoted them, and I think in some ways to get agreement from the public schools who were concerned about mass exodus of students that would disappear from their roles and also reduce their money. So, but I think what's been said already is valuable, and there's a lot of research that shows that helping kids move on when they're interested to move on into higher education, that's really an important thing to do. And there's a lot of research that shows it would be a good move to remove that prohibition, even though it may still cause some people some anxiety.
This might be something that we could take action on, Representative McFarland.
I'm hearing that we might not want to today.
It's good to push the committee just a little bit. Any further comments on this provision? Senator Erickson wrote.
Madam Chair, to that point, Representative McFarland, can you share with us some of the concerns so that we can prepare, you know, if you're going to have some questions to come back?
Sure, I think that House staff could help on that.
Okay, thank you.
What's the concern?
Madam Chair, the question, to you here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I believe the question was what the concern was, and I believe that the House, this is amending the K-12 statutes, and the House K-12 committee has not consulted on this issue.
In addition,
Mr. Berner,
there's a provision in the higher ed section of statute that refers to the same prohibition.
Representative House.
Would you expand on that? I mean,
Madam Chair, there's in Chapter 135A, There is also a prohibition, 135A101 subdivision 2 has this same prohibition in it. So the Senate bill amends the K-12 statute to eliminate it, but it leaves the one that's in the higher ed statute alone.
Can you repeat the citation, please, Mr. Berg?
135A101 subdivision 2.
That's the chair.
Senator Roebling.
I wouldn't think it would have been our intention to leave it in either place. I guess we didn't realize it was in two places, but I think we would maybe want to come back with something to make sure it's removed from both places if we're going to remove it. Otherwise, it doesn't serve any purpose.
Madam Chair,
Representative Haas.
We'd probably want to be getting comments to them from our K-12's respective committees.
Madam Chair, if it's informative at all to the committee, the higher ed prohibition was put in place by Representative Pulaski when he was the chair of the Higher Education Committee in the House, and he and a significant other number of members were concerned about the issue of recruiting from K-12 based on cost issues. And so he put this in place in the higher ed section of the statute.
Representative Bly.
As I remember, this is a program I've dealt with as an educator, and I think there also was concern about students not really being ready to participate, being encouraged to apply or to get involved in the program. And I think we probably should hear some more testimony about how it's working and what some of the concerns might be.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, it's just a prohibition for the institutions not to recruit, saying that it's a financial benefit to students. But if I want to, I can do whatever I want. If I want to go into all my high schools and say, listen, this is a really good way for you to save time and money later on, I can go do that. Or their teachers could do that, or their parents, or anybody, a parent group. Or
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
I doubt if all the people have read the rules anyway. Yeah. I mean, that'd be my guess. You know, it might be written in law, but I don't think it's, you know, one of those that's up on the wall with the commandments. I just can't believe.
All right. Well, this gives us awesome things to think about as we move forward.
Well, just <let's>, that.
Let's move on to the next item, information on college planning for students and families. This is a Senate position. We are on page 11 on the information on college planning for students and families, Senate provision. We had a fair amount of discussion in the division about the need and the desire to further link the K-12 system with the higher ed system, and to what were some mechanisms that we might be able to utilize to further identify and give our K-12 students information that might be helpful to them as they are preparing for their next endeavors. And this was an attempt at that, and specifically requires that information be provided to these students on the Minnesota Promise and the Achieve Scholarship. I hope anybody wants to provide any further comment.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if anybody has talked with the K-12 policy groups on that. Would this be changing their statutes at all?
Ms. Nowak.
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, no, this is a directive to the Office of Higher Education.
Okay. All right. We are going to skip the next provision. Now we're under the topic of other provisions.
We'll skip the voting one. We'll skip American-made clothing. The prospective student notice regarding criminal records. It's a Senate position.
And Chair.
Senator Roebling.
That was Senator Latches, right?
I'm just checking my list. It is Senator Latches, and so we'll skip over that until he's in the room. This could be a fun one. Textbook information. I like these provisions where they say same. But for the benefit of members in or people in the room, let's have a little information on what is in the provision that is both a House and Senate position. Ms. Novak?
Madam Chair, this was language from the Office of Higher Education, the Governor's bill that has been changed somewhat in both the House and the Senate. The section that appears starting on R35 going to R34 is, I believe, identical in both bills. It eliminates a requirement for the office to identify methods to on the distribution of textbooks to students. It actually repeals that provision. And then on R60, the two sections in the House and the Senate are similar but not identical, and it institutes a new requirement for the Office of Higher Education to work with the federal legislation and report back to the legislature after collaborating with student groups and textbook publishers and private and public colleges and systems on the new requirements under the federal textbook legislation.
Questions? Comments? Senator Roebling, would you like to make a motion on the provision on page R34?
They look.
Mr. Albrecht.
Chair, I move we accept the House language on page R34.
Is that
on page R33 and it's section 2?
Members, page R33, the House language, section 2. Senator Roebling moves adoption of R33, section 2. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. On to R60. Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair, the only difference is where the date is in the sentence, in the first sentence.
Madam Chair, I'll move the Senate language.
Representative McFarland moves the Senate language on R60, section 38. Any discussion?
Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. This is progress. We will move on to legislative oversight for federal funds.
Madam Chair, this is, as you can see, a House position that simply adds a cross-reference to an existing statute requiring the legislative commission to review federal funds either in the when they come in to agencies.
There is no Senate provision provided. Questions or comments from members? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair, how federal funds been watched before then or noted or tracked?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, the section that's amended here gives yes, higher education general authority to accept and disperse federal funds. Mostly in statute, and there's a process under Chapter 3, the legislative section, where the legislature and there's a review process where the governor has to submit proposals to spend federal funds, and the legislature has a time to ask more questions and approve or not approve. If the legislature doesn't approve, the governor still has the authority to accept funds, but there's another process. There are one or two places in statute where, like Office of Higher Education, that Chapter 3 process doesn't apply. The House has put this cross-reference, I think, in bills wherever that Chapter 3 process doesn't currently apply. So it wouldn't change the office's ability to receive or disperse federal funds. It just makes it clear that the legislative oversight process applies to those funds.
Senator Roebling, did you have a question?
Madam Chair and Mr. Berger, I'm wondering, so the legislative oversight, and that means us, or is there some oversight, like the Legislative Audit Commission, but they already have oversight over all that anyway.
Madam Chair, Representative Roebling, the process in Chapter 3 that's set up, sets up the governor applies and sends the information to the legislature that says where an agency is going to receive federal funds. And in the statute, it designates six people who are sort of the review panel who can ask for more information. Those are, I think, the Speaker and the Majority Leader and the President and the Senate, and then the Chair of the appropriate Finance Committee in either House. And those people are designated, and then it says, and anyone else they designate to ask for them. So, you know, it could be anyone really, but those are the anticipated people. And they can request more information from the administration. There is a 20-day period in which they can request more information. If the legislature doesn't act, the governor can go ahead with his plans. If the legislature says no or requests more information, the administration can provide more information and possibly the objection can be resolved. If it's not and the legislature adjourns, then the governor can go forward under his normal authority when we're not in session. So it provides for the legislature to ask more questions, but it doesn't restrict the governor's authority in any way.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So it's about the longest that federal fund allocations could be delayed would be not more than 20 days or so. I'm just worried about, you know, if this would delay allocations in case of some emergency or something.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Roebling, if the legislature objected, then and the governor and the legislature were not able to reach any kind of an agreement, then the end of the legislative session would then trigger the process where the governor could simply go forward. He then again has to notify the legislature and say, hey,
you're not in session, this is what I'm doing. So it could be to the end of the regular legislative session. So in this case, it'd be, you know, the 19th of May, the governor could, if the legislature were to object and stop the process, the governor would have to wait until the 19th of May to restart the process.
I wonder if anybody from the Office of Higher Ed would like to comment on this provision, and this might be a good time for us to switch chairs while they're commenting.
Madam Chair, members, we are the Office of Education actually does this as a matter of course now. The Department of Finance or Management and Budget requires it of us, so this would be a change in statute, not a change in our practice.
Mr. Michikanis.
We have no
opposition. After, we're going to be, we have no opposition to this. We do this anyway, right?
Okay, where are we? Senator Erickson Rowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're actually talking about some oversight on, legislative oversight on federal funds. And Senate does not have a position. The House has been making their case, and convincingly so, I think. If it makes sense to the House or the Senate side, I'd be willing to accept the House language, make a motion to accept the House language.
Representative Rukavina, the conferees are getting very productive work done with us gone.
Perhaps we should go over.
They've adopted like four provisions.
Yeah.
And we didn't really give them any authority to adopt provisions.
Well, I can tell
we've empowered them a little too much, maybe.
I can tell things have been hot and heavy because this chair is burning up on
me. My understanding, they adopted identical provisions. So. Although I was in a conference committee once where, I think it was with Senator Pogamiller, where we negotiated identical provisions. Okay, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, you know, Representative Hawes and I, we were just trying to kind of get us off to a good productive start, and we thought that you'd be, in light of your schedules, you know, we just wanted to do our part in moving this right along.
I think that's good. I mean,
numbers were great.
We do have to move along. So, okay, we are. Could you just recap for me? We lost Mr. Michikanis. That we're on page R36 of the big side by side, and there was a discussion about the federal fund language. And Senator Erickson Ropes, you want to recap?
Yes, Madam Chair. The House was just, as I said, making its case for putting this provision in there. Apparently, it is practice. We've heard from the department that happens anyway, and it's in several other pieces of law designating it, except in this one particular point, and they've made a good case for just continuing this in this particular area where they're dealing with federal funds coming in. It's a good provision.
I just want to hope that if the Senate does accept this House provision, that the House will return the courtesy when we have a good provision on the Senate side that makes sense and everyone agrees to, that we can work cooperatively on that. So we'll make the goodwill gesture and hope it'll be reciprocated. I'm losing my voice again, and you're going to be glad for that. Okay. Did you make the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes. So Senator Erickson Ropes moves that the conferees accept on page R36, section 4. Is that correct? Okay. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Just jump to the end. Yeah, Senator Roebling?
Senator Letts just returned, and we skipped the provision that he had authored a bill related to the notification of to students about if they had committed a crime that they should be notified that they may be ineligible to get a license to work in that area later on.
Senator Latz, then would you like to explain that provision to the House?
I'd be happy to. Maybe you can point me to the page where it's on, so we're on the same
page.
Page 12 on
the side by side, and in the short side by side, and in the long side by side.
I thought you had the whole bill wrapped up. That was so close.
We could have just waited a little bit longer. 32 in the long side by side.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, we heard a lot of testimony in the Senate from individuals who had enrolled in institutions. One in particular testified very powerfully. She'd gotten to the last stage of her education, was on the internship at the last semester, and all of a sudden her criminal history cropped up and made it exceedingly difficult for her to get an internship that was required for her to get the degree and ultimately be certified or licensed to practice in her field. She ultimately was successful in getting that internship, but only through a lot of extra hard work and perseverance. And frankly, I think many students would not have had that kind of ability. And so she was faced with the prospect of paying a lot of money to go to school, spending years getting that education, having been successfully rehabilitated through the criminal justice system, turned her life around and utilized a lot of taxpayer-funded education along the way as well, but hitting a dead end and not being able to get a job in the field that she'd been educated for. So we thought it would be appropriate to at least require the institutions to give a notice to the applicants that if you're looking for a degree in a particular field and hoping to work in a particular area and you do have a criminal history, you may wish to take a look into whether or not you're going to be able to get a job in that field or get the required licensing or certification before you enroll and go through the expense and the time of getting an education in that field. And so that was the basis for this provision. The private colleges did just raise a question with me today about whether they thought this would work in terms of regulating private colleges and a more technical issue relating to the standardized application forms that they use. And I haven't had a chance really to sort through that question, but in terms of the general policy, I think it's basically a notice. It was supported on a bipartisan basis. There's a provision in there that absolves the institution from any liability if they somehow fail to provide the notice. So you won't have a student suing them for the $40,000 in student loans that they took out when they couldn't get certified or anything like that. But it does provide some institutions to give that notice so kids have a heads up or people have a heads up when they're applying.
Well, Senator Rukavina.
And Senator Latz, I think I know you talked to me about this, and I can't remember who had this in the
House.
You remember? I can't remember. Representative Johnson had it.
Pardon me?
Representative Johnson had it, but he
didn't. Yes, Sheldon Johnson.
He didn't talk to me that much about it, but you know, and I guess I don't. You know, I could compromise on this, but we really should get 3 or 4 items for this one. First of all,
it's already gotten one.
It's you lawyers, Senator, that have caused a lot of this to happen with the law changes I've seen over the years that made something that never used to be a crime. Yeah. But I agree with the intent. But can we? I mean, if you look at lines 2333 and 2334. Can we lock somebody up at the institution just to make me feel a little bit easier, you know, at like a private college or the university? Maybe Iverson we can lock up if the university fails to do this. Because you're giving them, I mean, you're telling them, and I don't disagree with what you're trying to do, and then you're just letting them drive a truck through the requirement of the law anyway.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, last I checked, it's the entire legislature that has to pass the laws, not just the lawyers in the legislature. So everyone who was here that created the criminal histories at least the requirements for them is complicit in that. Secondly, you know, I have confidence that the institutions are going to comply with the law. And I don't think it's fair if there's some kind of an error in it to make them liable financially, you know, for what would ultimately be a pretty substantial liability. So I don't see how you criminalize that either. So civil liability, I think, would be inappropriate. Criminal liability would be inappropriate. I just think the institutions are going to go ahead and comply with the law.
Representative Rukavina.
Senator Lass, I've been proud of the fact that until last year I had not voted for a criminal justice omnibus bill, but PMAR has been so good at not throwing people in jail that I kind of voted for one and got getting weaker, I guess. More reasonable, maybe, answer. But how about if we just have them put it in their catalog or something, and then it's done. It would be a notice in there. Is this kind of going to be, because what I'm afraid of is if it's just a piece of paper or a something on the, that they're not really going to see, at least when they're going through the catalog of courses, et cetera, that, and all the other things that are in there, they'd notice, have that notice in there. So would that be maybe a better way to do it?
It doesn't specify where it's supposed to be given.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, this does not specify where that notice needs to be provided. I would anticipate it would be along with application forms or in the application itself. Frankly, the institutions would be well served to have a separate box portion of the application or piece of paper in which there was a signed acknowledgement by the applicant that they saw the notice, so there would never be any question about that. But it doesn't specify, and I've got no problem if we think it's appropriate to specify. Except that the institutions might want a little bit of flexibility, whether they put it in a catalog or an application or as an insert with materials that go out.
The website.
I think maybe at the lines on 2326, to each person applying, do kind of indicate that it would be on the application form. But why don't we hear from some people in the audience who, how do the post-secondary institutions feel about this provision? I don't recall us having a lot of people when we had this in committee, frankly. We had a lot of testimony. Is there someone here from the Private College Council who would like to comment? Hi, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Scott McMahon with the Minnesota Private College Council. First of all, thank you for this opportunity. I believe looking at the session calendar, we might have missed this hearing as I was welcoming my first child to the world, so I apologize if we didn't have a presence at this hearing. It was a good excuse for me, and my wife wasn't going to let me leave the hospital. So. Part of our concern with the language as it stands right now is this falls in Chapter 135A, which regulates public post-secondary institutions. All of the members of our association are nonprofit institutions. Two of them actually were chartered by the territory rather than the state of Minnesota. Traditionally, we have not been directly regulated by the state of Minnesota above and beyond our participation in financial aid programs. This holds true at the federal level as well. We just have some concerns that including this expands the scope of 135A into areas that we think are above the jurisdiction of this body at this point.
So you want us to treat you like the University of Minnesota? We could say is requested to.
We could go to that point.
How about they don't get any money from the state grant program if they don't do it?
Well,
I'm serious. I mean, this is not a big deal, and to say that you're worried about us having some jurisdiction, I mean, fine. And then just take state grant money if you don't do it. Senator Lance, would that be a friendly amendment?
It would. I was actually going to suggest something to that effect.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, Senator Lass, the issue that we would raise with that is that this moves well beyond the scope of financial aid, and we would question the legality of tying something that is well beyond the nexus of the financial aid program and the 25% of students at our institution section under that into 100% of students as to whether or not there is a viable connection between those two provisions.
Mr. Chairman,
Madam Chair, I was just kind of spoofing, you know. Now you're getting to the point where maybe we should have in the tax bill, you should pay taxes. That's a whole other issue.
Senator Lass.
Madam Chair, you know, the private colleges benefit financially from the students that apply there, whether they are for-profit or non-profit. And they benefit financially from the state aid that is given to those students. I don't think it's inappropriate to have some policy conditions attached to that state aid if the legislature feels that it's a significant piece, especially in this kind of a circumstance where a prospective student may pay all of the tuition, may go to the profitability of a private institution, and at the end of their education find that they can't get a job in their field. Then who has been used? In a sense, then, it's the private institution which is taking advantage of the student's own ignorance to benefit financially. I don't think that's appropriate, and much of that at taxpayer expense when there are state grants or aids involved. So I don't think it's inappropriate at all to include this kind of a condition, which is a minuscule administrative burden, I would suggest. You know, in, as a matter of state law, I think the legislature has ample authority to impose the regulation, I would suspect, although council may have some input on that.
Representative
Bly. Well, I guess I would hope that this could be worked out. You've implicated one of my constituents, Mr. Iverson, and some of your comments, and now you're going after the private colleges in my district and putting me at risk here. So I hope this can be worked out to a satisfactory to both sides. Yeah.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to echo Representative Bly's comment, I think that if we adopt a language that says a public or private post-secondary, et cetera, that they will comply. You know, we asked them for their opinion, and he offered his opinion. I don't know that we need to attach, a threat of pulling their funding.
Representative Rukavina suggested to Senator Lass that maybe that we could talk to Minsky and the university as well, because usually we do just request the university. This says every public post-secondary institution. If putting it in the catalog would be an appropriate notice in a very prominent place, would that be preferable to having it on the application form? Does that make it a better provision? I mean, this provision has passed the Senate floor as a separate bill as well as in this bill. So obviously the Senate feels very strongly about this, but we should really find out where Representative Johnson's bill is. If it's passed committee, maybe it's sitting on the House floor, I don't know. It was not given a hearing? Okay.
Madam Chair, I don't have a specific preference nor, frankly, a great desire to direct the institution specifically as to where to place the notice. I think we can leave that up to the institution. I would expect that they will comply with this. The issue of directing the University of Minnesota, I think, is a fair one in terms of the constitutional question, and we may need to tweak the language on that to accommodate that. I have no problem.
Is there anyone on the House side who is the House interested in working out a compromise on this? Is there anyone on the House side who'd like to work with Senator Lass on coming up with some language maybe consulting with Mr. Madden and the other parties?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina? I would suggest that Representative Bly.
Representative Bly?
Madam Chair, while we're on the subject, I would point out that, you know, in this section of statute right now, there's things that we're directing the privates to do along with the publics regarding immunization and sexual harassment, and we don't say may, we say shall.
Maybe it's not one of those issues that rises to the constitutional question.
Well, and it may not. But we'll accept your language on after
they work
out some kind of
thing. Mr. Zetterberg.
Madam Chair, we don't have any problems with the intent of this provision. We would like to ask you to consider one possible change, which has to do with when the timing of when notice is given to prospective students. In fact, we don't think doing it in the application is the most effective way to do it. We'd rather not do it that way. We would rather do it after a student has been admitted, but before they matriculate. The main reason is if you put it in an application, it'll be very easy for students not even to notice what it is. If they are told after they've been admitted, I think it would actually be more effective. It's also slightly less work for us because it's less students to deal with.
Yeah.
Just a suggestion. We don't object to the language as it is, but we think it would be better if...
Representative Lucavina.
Once they've been accepted and they're in the program and then...
No.
I figured you were going to make a little money off them before you told them they couldn't.
No, Madam Chair, Representative...
They wouldn't do that.
We're not beyond making a little money, but that's not the intent here. We would definitely provide the notice before the student started or matriculated.
Mr. McMahon, I know that there's some principles here, but we do think that we have run into problems with students who, you know, sign up for the nursing program at St. Catharines. They're very, very good at outreach for that program, and then, you know, they're embarrassed to admit that they had, you know, a problem in the past and they're trying to turn their life around. So they go through the whole program and then they find out at the end they can't get a license. So if you can come up with a suggestion as to how we could accomplish this goal, our goal, while still respecting your autonomy, you know, we're open to that. But you might have to put on a thinking cap to come up with that. Yes, Senator Representative Haas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just for academic reasons, I would like to hear your comments and what you think about putting it in the catalog. This seems like a real logical...
Mr. McMahon.
From an implementation standpoint, which is an area I didn't get into, other options besides the application would be much more feasible for us. About half of our schools participate in what's known as the Common Application, which is a national initiative with about 150 private colleges throughout the nation who have come together and created a common application that a student can fill out once and submit to multiple colleges. We have no ability to control what is printed on that application. So if it was deemed that it needs to be on the application, eight of our schools would not have the ability to go down that road and would need to find some other method to inform students.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I think I agree with Mr. Zetterberg that, you know, especially in the four-year programs, you go into the general program at first and then you apply for your major. And so, and not all majors have a problem with this. And it would be nursing and law enforcement and social workers. And only those students that may not be able to get a license if they have a criminal record would have to be notified. So at the point of application for a four-year major, they should be notified. But the only issue in the two-year programs is a lot of them move right into it. Then they kind of start the program that way. So it might be a different issue with the 2 years, but the 4 years, I would think that if when they're applying for their major program, that's the point where we should be notifying those students.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lass.
I would respectfully beg to differ. I knew when I entered college that I was going to go to law school, and I started taking courses in my first 2 years in college that would set up my political science degree and would qualify me better for law school applications. I'd hate to get to the point of applying, you know, picking a major and find out that I've wasted three or four courses and have to stay an extra semester or an extra year because I needed to develop a different coursework background to get into the graduate program I chose. So I would think that the application point might be the better point to do it. I'm a little worried about matriculation. I understand the issue about numbers, but you know, if someone is accepted for application, they decide they're going to matriculate, they tell other institutions that they're not going to be going there.
Could you remind me what that means? I've been away since I've been in college. Matriculate, is that where you choose your major?
You show up for your first day of class.
Oh, show up for your first day of class.
So, Madam Chair, at that point, they've already told other institutions they're not going to go there. So the day before they show up at the first day of class, they find out that the course they intend to take isn't going to get them where they want to go.
At Center Labs, they wouldn't be able to, it would be the same situation even if they went to another institution in that course of study. They still wouldn't be able to get licensed.
It's true, Madam Chair, but if they were, if there were another, if they found that they couldn't go choose a course of study, they might choose a different institution to get a degree in a different
something
area.
Something else. Okay.
I think the earlier in the process they're aware of this potential barrier, the more choices they'll have to direct their life and their options without foregoing or closing out different avenues too.
Well, I think we've heard, you know, unless there's someone else in the room that wants to be heard on this issue, I think the conflicts committee has heard enough, and I think we'll let Senator Latz and Representative Bly work with the parties to come to some conclusion for the conference committee. I know that when we were gone, you did adopt some of those same and similars. Why don't we look at what's left? Is this the same? Let's wait for that. One is the same. This is the similar. And I've already sent the same out. This is the similar coming second. Same. So let's start with the same, which I just kind of got passed down the line. Yeah, you did 3234 on it. So the first one on the list is on R3. This is the carryover provision. That's kind of standard language. Is that correct, Mr. Albrecht? The Office of Higher Education. Should we go, let's go through it all and then we can take one motion. Maybe. Is that okay? Okay, page R8. I shouldn't be doing this. Mr. Albrecht, why don't you do this and I'll save my voice.
Madam Chair and members, on page R8 is language for the Office of Higher Education that allows them to carry forward an appropriation from the first year to the second year. On page R9 is some language that may or may not be necessary, but regardless is not harmless in any way, and if there were to be appropriations or programs in the Health and Human Services bill that had work-study jobs, then this provision would make it so that the institutions employing those people didn't have to provide the matching funds that are generally required in those programs. Page R25. This is a provision in the University of Minnesota's section that just provides information on the amount of money that would be going to the Academic Health Center from I believe it's the tobacco tax money. On R32, this was a provision in the Senate that was from Senator Latz, I believe, that requires the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system to include in their course equivalency guides information about awarding credit or classes that would be eligible for credit that were taken in the military.
Is Senator Latz still here? Did it come back? We might not take his provision.
The next one on the list, R33 and R34, was already adopted. And on R36, that was also adopted.
Thirty-six at the very bottom. 27.3. You did adopt it?
Yes. Took the House language.
House language. Okay.
And I think we did 37. Oh, we adopted the Senate language.
Yeah.
Well, it was a little bigger.
We'll come to that in a
minute. We had a big debate.
Okay, so on the same list, the conferees have already adopted the last two things. So the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 provisions that Mr. Albrecht described.
Madam Chair, I'll move the language on page R3, R8, R9, R25, and R32. Do we have to do?
That is identical, yes.
Okay.
Okay, conferees are ready.
And I'll move the Senate language over.
That's identical.
Well, I'll move the Senate language, just so we gave you 5 items already.
Yeah, right. That does not count. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, now we have the similar list. Is the staff making recommendations here as to which language? You already did 43 and 60.
Okay, when did the first one?
You did 37. Okay, and that was took the Senate language, and you did 43.
We did.
And you amended it. Oh, it's just good work you were doing. And on page R53. Through 38.11 through 38.25. Appropriations not for buildings. Do you have any recommendations as to which one to take?
Madam Chair, there's only one meaningful difference, and it's at the end of the paragraph on the House side, and this was language that came from the Department of Finance, and apparently the House must have gotten it before I brought up the issue that Monday could be a holiday, and so that's why on the Senate side it says the first business day if the 21st is on a Saturday or Sunday.
Go with the Senate version then?
Yeah, we'll take now.
I was really hoping to take the House version on that one. The Senate, okay. And then R58 and 59. I don't understand. What's the difference?
The only difference, Madam Chair, is that the House language begins with the purpose statement that Senator Roebling wanted to remove in the Senate.
Is this
just
in the get my stuff there. H50.
Madam Chair, there's also a style difference. The House has it as a rider in Article 1, and the Senate has it as uncoded language in Article 2, which doesn't really matter.
Doesn't matter. Senator Roebling, this is your language on textbooks.
This is the language on the human...
the Human Resource Center. Yeah, I'm looking at the wrong section.
Their employees there.
There's an issue. Does that... We have it in...
No, Madam Chair, we just have it as uncodified language instead of a writer.
Instead of a writer. Why don't we take the House version then? House. And then on R60... Oh, and they did that already. Okay, so the motion is on R37, the Senate, on R53, the Senate, and on R58-59, the House.
Not sure how that needs that.
Okay, we have that. Is everyone clear on that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
While we're doing this,
do this and
this.
Okay. See the short one?
15.
15. Technical changes? Okay. On R51. Mr. Albrecht suggests that we do the technical changes of the short comparison, page 13. It says technical changes, and those are on, just one at a time, on R51.
Madam Chair.
Novak.
These were changes suggested by the reviser that the first one simply corrects a citation. Citation in the payroll, dealing with payroll deductions is wrong.
And that's in our bill because it has to do with Minsky or something?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. I would move.
Senator Representative Rukavina moves the House 28.17. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Okay, the other technical provision is on R55-56.
Madam Chair, again, this is another Minsky provision that was pointed out by the reviser that makes the change on, actually the changes on R56, lines 32.26 to 32.27. The statute citation that is stricken was repealed a number of years ago, and so it refers to Metropolitan State University, so it's putting in words rather than in the repealed section, the reference.
If we're adopting something and I forget to ask if anyone in the audience wants to comment, please come to the witness table or raise your hand or something to get our attention so we don't make any mistakes here without. At least we want to hear from you before we make our mistakes.
I'm sure I'll move the language on 32.26 and 27.
Representative Rukavina makes the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. If we turn to the first page of the short comparison, I just wanted to know, did the conferees discuss the... They did. If you did, you know, I'll get clued in later, but did you discuss the FAFSA application required of all students? Okay, I will. Unless you want to talk about something else, I would just go back to the beginning here and start working through. We still have another half hour. Is it okay to go if I say goodbye?
Go ahead.
So, I guess I would just like to know what this is about and why the House has it in your bill.
paper. Madam Chair, you're on the short sheet.
On the short sheet, right there. Yeah. It's on R37. You can look at the language.
Well, Madam Chair, if you want, we just felt, and, you know, there was a report here, I think, late last fall, how about, I think it was an estimate, like 20% maybe of 25 even, my staff is telling me that of students would qualify for some type of federal grant program or loan program, but mostly the grants, that, but they don't really, either they just don't want the hassle, or maybe they just don't think they qualify because of their family income, and we just thought that to have everyone apply just to see if they could get federal money, and before they get state money, would be a good idea. So that was the rationale behind it. So.
And does this apply to all post-secondary institutions in the state?
I believe it was just the, is it all the privates too? I can't remember. Okay. I get my staff is saying it's everyone. And I maybe OHE, they weren't too enamored, I think, to the way that we've drafted this, but I think they support the concept, so.
Mr. Michikanis, did you think this was a good idea, but had some suggestions for changes?
Madam Chair, members, I think the way that the conversation with staff yesterday, our initial concern was that the way it was constructed in the bill is that it would essentially limit all institutions because no one would ever get to 100%. But I think we had some other ideas of how to alter that. Ms. Grimes said it was part of these conversations as well.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes.
One of our concerns is that we have some new information from the National Post-Secondary Institution Student Aid Study, which is a national study that has a sample of 5,000 students in Minnesota that would help us really provide more information about exactly who is not applying now. And what we know, we have initial data that indicates that it varies a great deal with income, with whether they're full-time and part or part-time, and with how much tuition they're paying. Namely, if they're just taking one class or two, they probably don't fill out a FAFSA. It's totally up to the committee, but our suggestion would be that you allow us some time to study exactly who's applying and not applying and come back with more information next year.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, Ms. Grimes, I mean, you know, I'm not much one for studies. When I think
look into it.
When I think this could, you know, really be helpful, given the information we saw at the end of last year about this issue. So, I what is your concern to just have that there? I mean, as you're enrolling, that you be given a form to complete to see if you qualify.
Madam Chair, Representative Vukovina, there are students who may have applied their first year, for example, and found that they were not eligible for any aid, so they would have little incentive to apply a subsequent year. There are students who may be paying, for example, less than $2,000 in tuition and feel that it's not in their best interest. There are some, quite frankly, that, I don't know, as a matter of privacy, do not want to fill the form out, and so they don't fill out the form and they live without the aid. The idea behind the study would be to try to target the efforts to get more people to fill out the FAFSA to those students who are likely to qualify for aid, and make sure that they understand that it would be in their best interest to fill it out. There are students who are, basically their families have enough income that they're not going to qualify for any benefits through by filling out the FAFSA, so they may not. You know, why compel them if there's no chance that they're actually going to get any aid as a result?
Well,
Representative Cabina.
Madam Chair, can you come up with some language? You're a really intelligent lady, and you could probably come up with some language that says, you know, anybody taking three credits then out of work, two grand's still a lot of money to a legislator. Maybe not to somebody at OHE, but
You know, $2,000 is still a lot of money, and I was referring to Metzen on that one back there. Not either of you two at the testifying table, but maybe you could come up with some kind of language that says that to help us out here. Anybody taking over 3 credits or 5 credits, or you know, unless they waive it, but at least they'll know, because then the person at the college or whatever could say, you might qualify for federal money. We'd like to have you see if you do. I don't think we need a study to do that. You could probably come up with some language that would meet at least 2 of the 3 concerns you just threw out.
Senator Roebling.
Well, this isn't really that much of a burden for the institutions. It could be a burden for the families. The FAFSA can take a while to fill out and figure out. And I know that there's some families who know from having other children in their family, they have probably applied, know that they are not going to be eligible. So I guess I don't know why we would require them to fill out a FAFSA.
I just said unless they waive it. So in that instance, we could have that language, unless waived by the student. That's what I suggested, you know, a couple of different suggestions to them. And then that would meet your concern, because if the family's already looked into it and applied and they don't qualify, then they would tell their child, just sign the waiver because we've already looked into it, or sign the waiver because, you know, we have a lot of money and we don't want it, or for philosophical purposes or religious purposes or whatever. Just wait.
Representative Haas.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina, isn't this similar to what we did with the GI Bill and with the last money in, that they had to fill out all these other applications in order to get the Minnesota GI Bill?
I can't remember, Representative Haas, you were a little more connected with that. And in the end, we gave all our money to Veterans Services anyhow.
Madam Chair,
we
can answer that.
You could be right. Madam Chair, Representative Haas, it is true that in order to get money from the Minnesota GI Bill, you have to fill out a FAFSA. In order to get money from the state grant program, you have to fill out a FAFSA also. The question here is whether it's practical to require everyone in order for that whole institution to have anyone get a state grant. We would be glad to work on suggesting some language.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the clarity.
Madam Chair, do you want to move on?
On that same page, if we go maybe just right above it on the short side-by-side, it says the House provision requires the OHE to assist with small institutions getting accredited on R10. Maybe you might want to tell me what that is.
Sure. Remember, that was, if you recall, some of the, like, cosmetology schools and barber schools and a few of the others were not going to, and Ms. Grimes maybe come back.
Ms. Grimes might want to come back.
If they don't get going on getting credited to, so that those students qualify for Pell grants, and that they're going to be cut off getting any state grants. And we thought some of these smaller institutions, if we had a little more time, got a little help from OHE, maybe
whatever
age was, they wouldn't get cut off, because it's a concern. Some of the private schools have talked about it. As I said, cosmetology, more or less, in
barber schools. Mr. Michikanis.
Madam Chair, this has actually been an issue that's been around for a couple of years now about these schools and the accreditation. We did go through a lengthy process with them last summer, in the summer of 2007. And to try to get everybody that was not accredited up to speed, we brought in some accrediting agencies, we invited all the groups and the various institutions, and it's still an issue. There's no question about that. We can work with these same institutions. We're at a bit of a loss to know what else to do, because we've done quite a bit already. So that's our only concern.
Actually, I didn't get
I didn't allow people who wanted to testify on the FAFSA application a chance. So I want to back up before we get more into this Barber thing. And the University of Minnesota and NINSCU would have some FAFSA comments, so why don't you come forward? So back to R37.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Chris Holling. I'm the System Director for Student Financial Aid in the Office of Chancellor with NINSCU.
What was the last name again?
Holling, H-A-L-L-I-N-G. Just wanted to make a couple of comments. We agree with the spirit of the suggestion. There is definitely, we think, some need to look further, as Ms. Grimes suggested, into trying to figure out where, what are the characteristics of the families and the students that we want to try to make aware of the availability of financial aid. And so we would just suggest that it might be appropriate to approach this at the K-12 level. If we are requiring students and families to fill out a FAFSA at the time that they enroll in one of our institutions, that's good and may serve the purpose of making some of the folks aware that financial aid might be available and they didn't know about it. But if we're concerned that there's a body of students and families out there who aren't even considering applying to go to college because they don't think they can afford it, the place to make them aware is earlier in the process. And we would suggest maybe somewhere in K-12, where then they would know that, you know, college is a possibility and that's something maybe I should plan for and aspire to. Having said that, we also think that the idea of having a waiver for various categories is a good one.
Mr. Zetterberg?
Madam Chair, we also would agree that the idea of having a waiver is a good one. I just wanted to make a few other points. Students don't fill out a FAFSA. Typically, it's their families who do. And some students don't submit a FAFSA because their families are unwilling to do so. We, of course, have no way of knowing whether or not that's the case, but that is a fact. It's also the case that the state universities, the University of Minnesota, private colleges have at least a few students who come from families that have millions of dollars. And there's absolutely no reason to require them to fill out a FAFSA. It just makes more work for everyone. It's undoubtedly the case that there are students who don't fill out a FAFSA that should. That's a problem that is definitely worth addressing. But there are a lot of education programs that try to do that. The federal Get Ready program that's administered through the Office of Higher Education provides a lot of information about what you need to do to apply for and qualify for financial aid. We certainly do encourage all of our students to fill out a FAFSA, but as a practical matter, there probably isn't a college or university in the country that gets 100% of their new students to submit a FAFSA. It just does not happen. And for some, it is a reason of privacy. The federal government already has enough information on me. Why should I have to fill out another federal form? For others, it is because they absolutely don't need any kind of state or federal assistance. They're from a very affluent family. So, I mean, if at least we could waive the requirement, that would be helpful. But in fact, I think this is, you know, this is really a problem that needs to be addressed constantly with more education of prospective students about what they need to do. And simply requiring everyone, I'm not sure is going to do that.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Zetterberg, did you say that you do that at the university, that you encourage every...
Oh, absolutely. I would bet that every state university does it, every private college does it. It's an important part of our business. I mean, we have every interest in making sure that as many students as possible take advantage of federal and state programs. So we are constantly encouraging students to fill out a FAFSA, not only when they're new students, but each and every year. Just because they don't qualify the first year doesn't mean they might not qualify for something the second. So we're constantly doing that already.
Representative Slocum.
Madam Chair, the crux of this bill was essentially to get kids who come from poverty and or first-generation college kids to be able to fill out a FAFSA, which is a fairly intimidating process. I'm tending to agree with you. I think it might belong in K-12.
We were just talking about that. Me and Ms. Fine, too, but we don't control K-12. Maybe, would it be okay to just try this and think about this, Madam Chair, tomorrow?
try this for a year somehow with some suggested language like I just did to OAG and see if there's an increase at all. I'd be curious to the students' representatives if they could just come to the table and tell us how many of them were urged to fill out the MAFSA form.
Go survey your members.
Not my members. They represent the people.
Yeah.
The people.
People. Madam Chair, on behalf of the people. Jacob Lillard with the Minnesota State College Student Association. We definitely are encouraged by the intent behind this provision. It's definitely something that anytime we can do anything to help our students from graduating with more debt than they need, borrowing more money than they need, or having to work harder than is absolutely necessary to get through college, that's definitely something we want to see. I think some very valid concerns with the provision have already been raised, specifically if students are unable to get the financial information from their parents and aren't able to fill out the FAFSA, that could be detrimental to them. The idea of bringing it to the K-12 level, also very encouraging for those students. However, looking at our MNSCU two-year colleges, our average student is 29 years old, and that lends to a lot of working adults who wouldn't benefit from that. So I think somehow pursuing this provision while implementing some of the suggestions for the waiver or some way of making sure that students who don't need to fill out a FAFSA or are unable to fill out a FAFSA are still able to apply and get enrolled into our colleges, but making sure it's at that level because, as I said, our students tend to be more working adults and returning students who aren't going to be helped by a program in the K-12 system.
Okay, can I ask
Sarah Covina?
With either one of their experiences, where I'm coming from, Misabi, you know, one of my constituents, and Graham.
Yeah.
Can I tell your experience? Were you urged to fill one out? And
yeah, I was.
Mr. Allen.
I went to the U of M Morris, and the financial aid office pretty much encouraged us. Both my parents were in higher education, so it was kind of well known for them. But my experience was I don't know if I even saw my FAFSA. My parents filled it out so when I was in college. But I think generally we've talked about this with our student leadership and with the MNSCU Central Office, and I think we do need to kind of play around with the language. I think the intent is the goal that everyone that could get money is something that we all want to start. And just how to do that, the best approach, is something that I think we're interested to hear what the Office of Higher Education comes up, because some of the things that you had suggested is maybe some compromise or things that we've internally been talking about. So I think we're encouraged by that and would like to hear what that compromise is.
Do you want to hear from Mr. Littler about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Riccovina, I was one of those well removed from high school returning students, and I was encouraged by my financial aid office, and also my mother had gone to college and informed me that, you know, you should look into scholarships and grants and aid and probably fill out whatever forms you can. But I was encouraged when I applied through the enrollment services office, stop by the financial aid office, find out what they could do to help, and they were also very helpful in actually filling out the forms, because as some of the members have already mentioned, it's a very daunting form, and I didn't have my parents there to help me. I was going off of my own income information, so it was useful to have the financial aid office not only encourage me to fill out the form, but also be there to assist in the actual filling out of the form.
Representative Riccovina, where did you get that statistic that 25% of students would qualify and aren't applying? Is that a local Minnesota statistic or is that national?
Actually, I got that statistic and I took it to be gospel because it was given to me by former State Senator Jerry Janicic, who saw it in a newspaper. And I can't remember. One thing you know in life, your bartender never lies to you. I don't know if Mr. Janicic remembers
this year,
if
it was
Minnesota or national.
Well, I think it would be good because I think our decisions should be data driven. So we should have good information before we make any decision. But I think in the meantime, in the interest of trying to facilitate one of the House's key provisions, it would be helpful if the Office of Higher Education would help consult with people and maybe come up with some language so that we could start looking into this a little more. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on that, line of thinking. I think that it would be helpful to hear from the Office of Admissions and the Office of Financial Aid, because I suspect that it might be beneficial for us to hear sort of what the protocol is.
Right, the protocol, the good practice, is that kind of what the admission officers, the financial aid officers are taught to do. And then I wonder with Mr. McMahon, if this is another one of those areas that the private colleges don't want us to tell them what to do. It would apply to you, I assume.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. With this being connected directly to the financial aid side of things, we are a very willing player. I do want to reference, given the fact of where our tuition and fee levels are, our schools are very aggressive in working with students to educate them, to hound them, to get as many people signing up as possible, because it truly is in everyone their students' best interest.
Thank you.
I'm sure if we could touch a little more on the, office working with smaller institutions.
Okay, back to the Barber School issue.
And then we could break because we have to have the staff that will break before we go to the center council.
What else did you want to talk about? You want the office staff?
Well, I just don't know if there's anything. I was concerned about it. I had some complaints and... I know Mr. Michigan has said, well, they tried to maybe a little more hand-holding and urging can get them, some of them at least, and there were a number of them, I think, that we can get them so that, if I recall, like one institution, there were students, there were 12 students, and they qualified for like $20,000 for state loans. They're costing them $20,000. And a lot of them would have qualified for the grant.
Is there a reason why these schools are not achieving accreditation? Did you discover in conversation with them?
Madam Chair, the accreditation process is not simple, and it is expensive. We've told you all along since when the legislature adopted this language in 2007 that we expected it to cost $20,000 to $30,000 for an institution to get accredited, and perhaps as much as $20,000 a year to stay accredited. Now, we did hear from one small cosmetology school that went through the process. It cost them $10,000 to get accredited. So maybe our estimate was a little on the high side. There are only two national organizations that accredit barber and cosmetology schools that are recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. And the purpose of the whole provision is to get Pell Grants for students who are currently not getting them. Students don't know that if they went to the cosmetology school down the road, they could be getting a Pell Grant when they're not getting one at the one where they're currently enrolled. That's the goal, is for them to get their Pell Grants if they're eligible. These are small institutions. When we had our workshop, we did encourage them to band together, perhaps, and hire a consultant to help them through the process. We brought in the federal people who talk about what it's like to, what institutions have to do in order to participate in their financial aid programs. We brought in the two accrediting agencies. We brought in a consultant that helps people get accredited. And we brought in a school that has recently gone through the process so they could offer their advice about what it was like for them.
What can they do?
It is not simple. It is time-consuming. But it is what's required in order to participate in the federal programs.
Well, no, it isn't. No, it isn't.
Madam Chair,
why did we do that? You know, that was my first year in this position, and I can't remember. I remember a little bit of the argument, but why did we, what was the impetus behind doing this? Just to help
acquiring accreditation? Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chair, it was to try to make sure that students get their Pell Grants. Because in calculating a state grant, we subtract their Pell Grant whether they get one or not. Because we don't want institutions to have an incentive to substitute state money for money that they could be getting from federal programs. And so the idea was that some students may be getting small state grants because we are assuming a large Pell Grant that they don't get because their school is not participating. That student doesn't know that if they went to the cosmetology school that is participating in the federal program, they would be getting much more free money than they're currently getting.
Or the state, yeah.
Next year, the maximum Pell Grant award will be $5,550. So there will be students where we are subtracting that much in calculating their state grant, meaning they get a small state grant. Those students don't know that if they went to the school down the road, they could be getting the Pell Grant.
But in order to get the Pell Grant, the group has to be certified.
Has to be accredited.
Accredited. How many schools are out there are we talking about? So when you had your workshop, how many showed up?
Approximately 30 schools. I believe about 26 showed up. Some of the schools that object most strongly were contacted repeatedly, and they refused to come to the workshop.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
So it was your initiative.
Mr. Chair, yes. Right after the legislation passed in July of 2007, we sent a letter to all of the schools saying this was going to be a requirement that was four years down the road, but that accreditation takes some time, and we wanted to make sure everybody was notified that the requirement was in the offing. Then in 2008, in August and September, we repeatedly contacted institutions asking them, what is a good day in October for us to offer a workshop so that we can help you through this process? We repeatedly contacted them for that, and then once we set the workshop date, we repeatedly contacted all the institutions to try to encourage them to attend. Some chose not to attend or perhaps had other commitments that day. As they contact us, as time goes on, we continue to try to offer assistance and guidance in what they need to do.
Is there anyone else here that would like to be heard on this issue before we adjourn for the day? Thank you very much. I think Representative Rukavina has requested a dinner break, and you have another conference committee, and the gavel goes to you tomorrow, and what are your plans?
And I'm sure I'd like to meet at 9 a.m.
9 a.m. in this room?
Yes.
Okay, and then how long?
Actually, I'd like to meet at 8:30, but you have a meeting at 8:30, right?
You have a meeting at 8:30. Right?
Well, maybe Senator Lynch can
start us off. She's on my committee.
I'm ready.
Oh, well, she can't do that.
Senator Erickson Rowe.
9 o'clock.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have another conference committee beginning at 8:30.
Okay. Well, we have to meet. Because you're going to meet with Tom Stone. Are we going to come back? Are we going to meet in the morning?
We're off and on, I hope. And you, I don't know when you're in session. We can
meet. We're in session at 11.
We can meet while we're in session.
11 to 2.
I thought it was 3. So we will try to meet from 9 to 11. We'll go check in, and then we'll punch in, and I don't know.
We're not allowed to do that, so we couldn't come back.
We, I know. We have much more. We're not as quite as uptight as you can.
So
we.
I don't know yet, but we'll try to meet.
Okay, from 9 to 11 for sure tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay, the conference committee is adjourned.